Am I talking all right? Can you follow this? Is this, does it make sense? I mean, notice here that for hundreds of years, and maybe a thousand years in the Western tradition, various geniuses kept bumping against this and not understanding that they had a hold of the tail of the dragon. Notice that in our time it is so common that you have a hard time getting a student to study his calculus. And a used calculus textbook is worth like 2 cents. Do you understand that if you just limit yourself to our time, you're not going to understand what's valuable? Because to you, a used old calculus textbook is nothing. I'm telling you, it is unbelievable treasure. It's incredible. It's the summation of a couple thousand years of genius. And it's so profound. You know, and in the Tibetan tradition, the Vajrayana, you never throw sacred material away. You never destroy it. There are always places where it's kept. The same thing in the Jewish tradition. You never destroy scripture. There's a part in a synagogue, Geniza, where you put old tattered things and just leave them there. It's like the American Indians that once you've done a Sundance, an Okan, you never destroy the Sundance pole and the poles of the lodge. You leave them there to rot, if they will. But you never destroy it. And that's a wonderful thing. We should have some place to put old calculus textbooks. It's on that order. So, Hadamard says, adapting the expression of Poincaré, this is a French mathematician, Henri Poincaré, taking an expression of his, we can say that things are more or less discovered, not discovered outright, from complete obscurity to complete revelation. In other words, there's a phase process of discovery. And so you don't want to know that Marconi discovered the radio. You want to really understand, how did this whole process happen? Because that's where the true meaning is. So that if you're going to integrate something, anything, to the point of really understanding it, you have to understand its meaning in a broad enough base to be able to bring this into focus, so that this whole process is a learning method of how to learn anything. And we're using it here because it's the basic way. What is basic here? We learn to see nature in an archetypally natural way because we learned how to express it mathematically in just this sequence. One step consists in acquiring the idea of a principle, another, if not several others, in giving a precise form to that idea and driving it far enough to be able to make a starting point for further researches. In the present case, this was the work of Newton and Leibniz. But the differential calculus is not the whole infinitesimal calculus. There is a second branch called the integral calculus, the fundamental operation of which is the value of plane curvilinear areas, and this implies a discovery which lay deep and had been entirely unsuspected. For instance, the fact that integration is nothing else than the converse of differentiation. So there's an integral calculus exactly equal to a differential calculus. So that the equation of the mind's operations in its true wholeness is that there's an equanimity of balance, there's a symmetry to the mind. It's the symmetry exists to the point of beauty. It is the symmetry of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, only done in an expressive form. I had a fellow student about 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I guess now, at the University of Wisconsin, who was doing a research paper on recursive functions. His name was Larry Balch. And he worked for a whole year on this one little 8-page paper on recursive functions, and he was buried in it, day in and day and night. And I asked him one time, I said, you know, you got to drink sometime, man. You got to get drunk sometime. No, he says, I'm drunk all the time. He says, it's beautiful. That's how it is. So that integration is nothing else than the converse of differentiation. Who made that essential and difficult discovery? And then he goes on and he talks about Leibniz and Newton for a little bit. We'll Xerox this and make a copy for you. What's important for us to understand is that all reality works in this way. The principle holds everywhere. So that when one looks to see life, what is life? Well, life really physically has to do with the double helix structure, which is biochemistry, which is the organic form of chemistry. So that if you look with the symbolic eye and you look to try and understand chemistry, what is one of the fundamental principles of chemistry? And we're going to take a break as soon as I deliver this to you. I choose a textbook of chemistry, which happens to be a very good textbook of chemistry. It's by Linus Pauling. And chapter 6 in Pauling's General Chemistry, it's called the chemical bond. Because you can't have any chemical structure unless you can have a chemical bond. What exactly is a chemical bond? Let me give you Pauling for just three short little paragraphs, then we'll take a break. This is page 148 in a chemistry textbook. Except that it's written by a genius who really understands what he's doing. He's like a magus of chemistry who's just simply able to tell us the truth about the chemical bond. For over a century, chemists have systematized the formulas of compounds by assigning certain combining powers called valences to the elements. You understand it's a form of Genesis. It's like Adam naming the creatures. The assigning of valences to the elements is like a new Genesis. This is oxygen was the first one, the first element. Joseph Priestley, a friend of Benjamin Franklin's, was the first to isolate any element. It was oxygen. We now know exactly what the elements are, and we know the whole mythology of the elements. We know they occur in families. Any mythology has a family structure in its archetypal level, even of the families of elements. And we know that these elements are universal. You can go to any galaxy, any place in the universe, and oxygen is oxygen. An organic basis of life are either going to be carbon or silicon, one or the other. So, for over a century, chemists have systematized the formulas of compounds by assigning certain combining powers, valences, to the elements. The valence of an element was formerly described as the number of valence bonds formed by an atom of the element with other atoms. The effort to obtain a clear understanding, notice the yoga, the effort to obtain a clear understanding of the nature of valence and of chemical combinations in general has led in recent years to the dissociation of the concept of valence into several new concepts. Now notice that we're schooled in a kind of a Freudian schmaltz to think that dissociation is terrible. Oh, I'm dissociating. It's a natural part of the process of learning. If you can't dissociate, you're in trouble. It's tantamount to saying that somebody can't play. Now, you can go to very expensive psychiatrists who try to keep you from dissociating. Well, what do you think is going to happen to you? You're going to become another California raisin. You ain't going to have any of the wine in you. The knack is not to be afraid to disassociate when it's time to do it. So what? Zorba says, boss, you got everything, but a man needs a little madness too. Otherwise, he never will cut free. And there's a time to dance and sing. There's a time to chuck it all and get up and go. And you have to preserve that also in your repertoire. Freedom. Play. So, dissociation. The masters of dissociation were the Marx Brothers. You want to undo somebody in a hurry? Show them to Harpo and Groucho. The effort to obtain a clear understanding of the nature of valence and of chemical combination in general has led in recent years to the dissociation of the concept of values, of valence, dissociation of the concept of valence into several new concepts, especially covalence and ionic valence. We shall discuss these concepts and the related question of the nature of the chemical bond in the present chapter. Chapter 6-1, The Nature of Covalence. The atoms of most molecules are held tightly together by a very important sort of bond, the shared electron pair bond. That's what covalence is. Shared electron pair bond. Notice that the idea of pairing doesn't just occur in Taoism, doesn't just occur in Plato. It's right there in chemical structure when you really understand it, when you see it for what it is. All chemical structure, and thus all biochemical structure, happens because of this phenomenon that an electron is able to be shared by two atoms at the same time. Why do they stay together? They stay together because they are together. It's a mystical insight of the highest order. They're together because that's how they are real. It's like a marriage made in heaven. No amount of delusion is going to separate them. You can think that the molecules of this brass are going to fly apart because you're feeling so anxious that it's going to explode, right? Well, you can feel that way all day. It's not going to explode. It is together. And, of course, the way that the ego gets around is to say, oh, well, matter is nothing. Matter is evil, man. It doesn't do what I think it's going to do. But in fact, matter is spiritual because it shows in its actuality what is true about it. And we know that health comes from this empirical, pragmatic wholeness now, to see it for what it is. Not what you think it is, or hope it is, or hope it isn't, but for what's there. So here's Pauling again, and then we'll take a break. The atoms of most molecules are held tightly together by a very important sort of bond, the shared electron pair bond, or covalent bond. This bond is so important, so nearly universally present in substances, that Professor Gilbert Newton Lewis of the University of California who discovered its electronic structure, called it the chemical bond. In fact, for a long time, Lewis died in 1946, for a long time it was thought to be the chemical bond. We know now that there is also an ionic valence that happens, especially in biochemistry. How do cells stay together? Because the channels between cells are ionic channels. Cells have little open doors, and they stay together because their open doors are shared, ionic channels. So when it comes to understanding the metabolic reality, say, of a human body, you have to understand that the health of these ionic channels is the first level of universal conception. And that a lot of this has to do with mineral balance. You can have perfect vitamins, and if you are ignoring the minerals, your whole electrolytic situation may be brought into question. Let's take a little break. I'll leave these books open. You can take a look for yourself. And we'll run off some pamphlets on totemism.
This whole book, you just read all the ones that
you read. We need to make copies of this. You want to Xerox it? Before we get back to our structure of our material for today, I've been trying to get, as you know, the video of the film Moby Dick. And I don't know, did somebody try to follow up that tower record lead? I got to a dead end. But it turns out that Robert taped the thing off television one time, so next week he'll bring that version. Does anyone have a capacity to make a tape of a video? Do you? So if you bring it next week, I have a blank video, and then Tony can run it off. At least we'll have something. Now, I took the money that we collected. Everybody put in $2 a piece for that Moby Dick video. And I invested it into a film, a video of a film that we'll use during the myth section. And that film is Black Orpheus.
Yeah.
Which is $85. So if some of you are tired of eating large-sized pizzas and want to the difference between the cost of a medium size and a large size into the kitty, I thought the way to handle the film situation for the myth was to put the ritual and myth together as a tandem. In other words, you've seen nature, and that one of the archetypal structural processes of nature is that it always occurs in pairs. Nothing occurs by itself, it always occurs in pairs. So it's the correct way of seeing, to steal a line from the great American photographer Edward Weston, he said, composition is the strongest way of seeing. So that you have to see with a composing eye. And you can see that the pairedness holds all the way down to the nuclear, molecular level, and all the way up to the level of principles on the level of cosmologies. It just happens to be so. So that, for instance, a universal sign of inner focus is to bring the two hands together. Now, whether it's a prayer, or whether it's a gassho, or whatever it is, there's a universal sign of inner focus. And the universal sign of outer focus is the one hand. My hail to you. The reception of this hand, your reception of it is the complement. It makes the pair. Our two hands together meeting is the shared pair. This is the inner focus, that's the outer focus. That's a valency bond. between people socially, or between the elements in ourselves interiorly. So that the pairing now of ritual and myth, I think, is going to work out. And in order to do this pair right in ritual and myth, I want to have three films. So aside from the material that we're using, the books and so forth, I have three films which exemplify myths, but do it in such a ritual, pure way that you can use it for the ritual and the myth together. So sometime during the next 6 months, we're going to spend a long time on this, no longer than usual, but long enough, try to sit down in groups. Try not to see it individually, but try to sit down in groups and see these three films. Black Orpheus, Shane, and Forbidden Planet. These three films are all myths. Now, Forbidden Planet, don't let it fool you, is based on Shakespeare's Tempest, which itself is an archetypal structure. The old Shakespeare was really somebody. We use nothing but the best here. It's like the old Shakespeare and the old Euripides, the Bacchae. I mean, these are fabulous people. They're more fabulous than unicorns or dragons. People on this scale are incredible. So Shane and Forbidden Planet and Black Orpheus all deal with myths. When you want to talk about the myth of the hero, the Wild West gunman, who tries to go back to ordinary life and realizes that only by being himself can ordinary life go on, and so has to become the gunman again. I mean, it's the myth of the hero in the most pristine kind of way. So Black Orpheus shows the Orpheus myth, Shane shows the hero myth, and Forbidden Planet shows the Magus myth. And these three myths are shown as good as they've ever been done. Now, what also controlled my selection of this, I'm an educator and I'm always trying to look out for ways in which you can digest this material. All three of these films were made in the 1950s. So they go together. Their flavors will marry. The 50s film community was enough of an epoch that it has a very distinctive flavor. It isn't the 40s, it isn't the 60s, it's just the 50s. So these three films on video, try sometime in the next 6 months to see them a couple of times. The aesthetic way is to see it once and just let the experience be there. The second time is to see it with an idea towards placing yourself in the experience of seeing it, and then the third time is to try and see it in your way. In other words, by the second viewing, you should have some kind of a theory about what that's all about. And then the third time, try to see it in terms of that theory. Is that what that's about? Am I seeing this right? So that one moves from experience in the first case to a kind of informed experience in the second case, to a kind of a symbolic theory in the third case. Notice here that meaning is being generated and interiorized and brought together and held by an idea. Oh yes, I have an idea about Forbidden Planet. Now notice that all of this material is protean, in the sense that you can open it up indefinitely. And so you just have to gauge it by the time available to you, by your own inclination. And I have all the material here that you need. I mean, if you want to go into this material, if you get interested in the fact that Shane as the American Western hero occurs primordially not in terms of the characters that are there, but that they occur in terms of the land which is there. So if one wants to understand Shane, one has to put Shane, without the middle ground of the people, in the landscape. The American West is a virgin land. And everyone knows that the hero, the God-man, has a divine mother. Well, the virgin landscape of the American West is the mother. And there are all sorts of things that you can go into. And if you want, I have all the materials that you need. You can go as far as you want. If you want to get into Shakespeare's Tempest structure behind Forbidden Planet, I have all of that material. You can go into it as deep as you want to go. And the same for Black Orpheus. I think I have everything in English and a couple of things in French on the Orpheus myth and all of its ramifications, so that you can really go into it. You don't have to. I realize that all of you are busy, and it takes a lot to even just make it here on a Saturday. But there are some times when you can read on breaks. And there are some times when you realize that I've got to know this. I need to know it. It's a little bit more desperate than I want to know or I'd like to know. There are some times when you realize that this really means something to me. And I'm the kind of teacher who's telling you that you have the right to know. Whatever is necessary for you to be real to yourself, you have the right to know. And this is a good time to do it. This is the time to do it. Because you have the right population of friends. You have a teacher that's not going to give up. You have the material available. And you have a situation that is fairly trustworthy. So that you can bring the meaning out as deep as you want and have a situation where it can be fed into. Just like somebody was saying during the break, there are some times when realizations begin to scare you. This is a trustworthy situation. This is a good nest that you can hatch any kind of egg that your mind can see or that your feelings can bring out. Because this educational structure is psychologically balanced enough in integration and differentiation that in its two-year cycle, almost anything that you can bring out in realization will be able to be channeled in such a way. It's like the principle of walking on snow. If you walk with your natural feet on snow, you're going to sink in and you're never going to make it back. But if you use snowshoes, it differentiates the weight so that you can walk right on it. You can walk here on the psyche in a way which, if you tried to do it yourself, it would be like quicksand. The first step would sink you because you'd never be able to get out of the step. So this situation is very, very advantageous to growing in any dimension that you really need to. And everybody has a little bit different emphasis. But all of us are here because we know now that it's important for us to do it. No one else can do this for us. And now is the right time in life to do it. So these three films are available, and there's a good VCR and a television in there. And when you're here, the house is open to you. It's just that way. So don't feel trepidatious of going in. Please don't spill tomato sauce on my bedspread. It isn't quite that open. But you're free to make this stuff available. All right, let's come back. What are we trying to do? We're trying to round out nature by trying to understand how paredness occurs as a primordial structure. Notice that the key to unlocking the 3 months on the ritual is making a pair of masks. And notice that it isn't conceiving something, it isn't daydreaming about something, it isn't remembering something, it's making the pair of masks. The activity of making the masks is all important. In other words, the activity is more important than the actual masks. in the ritual section. In the myth section, the masks themselves will be what's important, but in the ritual, it's the making of it that's really important. And what's important in experience is to do it. Whatever turns out will be all right. Whatever turns out. I don't have my fingers crossed. Whatever turns out is all right. It's the activity of doing it. Because we'll see that when you compose the symbolic I and you see what ritual is, it's what we do. And in our life forms, almost in the 21st century of the common era, we have so many tens of thousands of years of sophisticated ceremonial ritual ingrained in us, that whenever we start to do something which is the least primordial, it kicks all of this stuff in. It's there. You don't have to put it in. I think the classic example I always use for my own life, because I can verify it and speak for it with veracity. My daughter, I guess most of you know, is adopted. She's a Blackfoot Indian child. Raised in my household. And for her second birthday, she was 2 years old on that day, I played a record of the A1 Blackfoot dancers and singers. And for the first time in her life, she heard that kind of dance music and chanting. And spontaneously, she began with the elbows up, going through the steps, the special shuffle step that was exactly appropriate to that chanting. It's in the bones, it's in the blood, it's in the psyche. It is so indelible. But the intelligent thing is not to overlook it or to gloss it over, but to bring it out for what it is and let it generate what it will and use that to develop the base of your meaning. Everybody has that in them. And the wholeness of our personalities depends on our courage to do that, to bring out what is really there. And not to be afraid of that, or not to be ashamed of that, or not to be proud of that, but it's just that that's what's there. And it is there, and it's quite real. So the whole funneling activity of the ritual in the mask making is just to make these two masks, to go into that enterprise of doing it. So don't think about doing it, just start doing it. And as you play with it, the masks will occur out of the play. It's a divine play. It's like the original insight, which is greatly watered down now, sandbox play, is a part of therapy. I don't know if you've ever seen where a little room with all the shelves lined with little figures and various things, and then a sandbox, and then you can just play. And eventually, the games, the sets that you play with these figures in the sandbox will tell a story over and over again. All the different stories will be versions of a theme. And it's that theme that you need to tell yourself, that you haven't been listening to, and that your psyche is out of balance because you haven't been listening to it. And the psyche is trying to tell you all the time, hey man, this is important. And it quits jabbing you in the psychic ribs about the time that you open your ears and say, all right, I'm ready to hear that story. I want to hear that story. I'm enthusiastic about this. And your psyche says, well, all right. We'll let you get rid of the twitch then, if you'll hear the story. It's like that. It's like on a childish level. But it's silent bargain making. You never hear the deals. It's just that the deal is struck and it happens. It's like the fairy tale that the scars disappear. Even the scars disappear. Because they were only there because of an impasse which you had insisted upon by being short-sighted, one-halved, flat about reality. And what the psyche needs to do is to be whole. I mean, that's its basic principle. It needs to be whole. It's happy when it's whole. And you may think, oh, well, this little part is vulgar. We're not going to have that in. It may have to be in. So you may have to have some embarrassing moments. The mask-making endeavor, then, is what to do. Try not to think about it. Play with it. It's a form of play. Mask-making is like a form of play. The two masks are important. Think back now. In ancient drama, where drama first began, like in archaic Greece, drama began with the first Greek tragedy that has any form is Aeschylus's Persians. And out of that whole experience was distilled finally in Roman times the mask of comedy and the mask of tragedy. There were two masks. These two masks, the masks of the theater, are the archetype of the paradness of masks in human dramatic experience. There are not three masks. There are only two. But there are, in fact, two. So what we're doing here in the next 3 months is we're bringing out of our own experience, in the form of the activity which we're doing, the two masks, like comedy and tragedy, which are meaningful for us. We may not get it right after a while. It took several hundred years for comedy and tragedy to be refined to be those two masks. And by Roman times, it was taken for granted. But in the times of Aeschylus and Sophocles, no matter how brilliant they were, that was not obvious. There was nothing obvious about that. And the classic statement is that no one had a more balanced mind than Sophocles, when this was true. And even though he lived to be almost 100 years old, he never saw that as the archetype. How do we know? Because Sophocles never wrote a comedy. Do you understand? There are no comedies by Aeschylus, no matter how great that he was. There are no comedies by Sophocles. There are no comedies by Euripides. There are no tragedies by Aristophanes. There are no tragedies by Menander. Do you understand? The classic Greek mind was flawed on an archetypal level. Who is the first human being to write comedies and tragedies in perfect balance? He didn't write any comedies in church. Shakespeare. William Shakespeare. But notice what happens in the balance. He writes comedies and tragedies, is that all? He writes histories also. Notice the incredible discovery. It's like a mystical insight of the first order, that when your personality is balanced, it has a triadic structure. The pairedness includes not only the pairs, but the synthesis of the pairs as the whole. And Shakespeare's histories are not comedies and they're not tragedies, but it's the wholeness of human life. And of course, one of the first of Shakespeare's histories where he's trying to get it down is Henry V. And there's a very good film version of that showing now in Los Angeles, Kenneth Branagh. And I have Sir Laurence Olivier's Henry V on video cassette. It's important to see that in Shakespeare's histories, there's an evolution. And Shakespeare's histories evolve to to an incredible surrealistic point that at the very end of his career, Shakespeare was in a position to write a history of a future. And the future history in Shakespeare is the Tempest. It's the archetype of things to come. The Tempest is the only Shakespeare play to be set in a new world. And believe me, in 1610, it was really still a new world. There wasn't much that had happened. So there are moments of high discovery that happen, but only occur to us when we go on the ladder of experience and build our sense of the meaning of the structure of what's happening. And there are some high vistas of vast intelligence that are available, not just about Shakespeare, but about ourselves. We all of us have a lifeline which is coherent, and that lifeline leads to a flower. And it's important, in terms of this cosmos, that some human beings actually flower, because Mother Nature is very unhappy if she gets bouquets of buds all the time. She gets riled because she's planted a lot of flowers and she wants to see some blooms. And she gets really ecstatic when there are some blooms in the cosmos. And she calms down and says, well, that's what I meant. That's why I put those seeds in and tended it all these billions of years so that these flowers could blossom. So in a way, we're all blossoms that can be. And we have a lot of tailwind from Mother Nature. It's a very blessed circumstance, actually. The paredness is important. And we were talking about it this morning in terms of mathematical method, integration and differentiation are a pair. We were talking about it in terms of chemical structure. The covalent bond is the very basis upon which elements build into compounds. Now we're going to take a look at the way in which that pairedness also is the structure, the double helix. The double helix is a pair. So that the dynamic, largest form, universal form, of the way in which life occurs takes the pairedness of the covalent bond in chemistry and through the double helix structure comes into the purview of mathematical analysis. And we'll find that in the double helix, there is such a thing as a word of creation, a codon, which has three elements in it. And we'll learn that in the vocabulary of creation, natural creation, there are 64 codons of three terms each. Now, there are a lot of combinations of those, but there are only 64 codons, and each codon has three elements in it. So that the double helix shows a fantastic integration into the I Ching. There are only 64 hexagrams. And the basic working unit of a hexagram is the trigram, and it's based on a pair, yin and yang, in its complete transformational ecology. So there is such a thing as a comparison of the I Ching and the molecular biology of modern genetics. Comparison, they fit together like two hands of prayer. So we're moving towards that. What I'm developing here for you is an insight path of discovery from the opposite angle from which the textbook presents it.